This holiday season, what does comfort look like to you? For me, it's slowing down, finding calm amid the chaos, and making home a place where everyone can truly relax. That's where Avocado Green Mattress comes in. Avocado helps you create your own natural oasis, a calm, cozy space filled with certified organic comfort. Their handcrafted mattresses are designed for deeper, more restorative sleep, and their breathable pillows and soft organic bedding bring that same luxury to every part of your home. Hosting family this year, Avocado's sustainable furniture, like their beautifully made city bed frame, helps you create a warm, inviting space where everyone sleeps well and feels cared for. Everything Avocado makes is thoughtfully crafted with the planet in mind, certified organic, non-toxic, and built to last, so you can feel good about the comfort you bring into your home. Because Avocado believes in being better for you and better for the planet. Prioritize rest and recharge with Avocado's organic comfort. Head to avocadogreenmattress.com today to create your natural oasis and save big during their holiday sale. Avocado, dream of better.
Mike O'Mara, Radio Entertainment.
Hocus Pocus by Focus, for those of you who have a top 40 interest. You've heard us talk about the movie Tapawingo, starring our friend Chad Dukes, and now's your chance to see it for yourself. It's available now, streaming everywhere that you can rent movies. Please do this. Today we're bringing one of the film's greatest rivalries straight to the Mike O'Mara Show. Joining us is the man Chad desperately wants to take down in the movie, Nate Skoog, played by none other than John Heder. Yes, that John Heder, the legend behind Napoleon Dynamite, Blades of Glory, Benchwarmers, and countless quotable moments that define awkward comedy greatness. John, thank you for being here, and welcome to the Mike O'Mara Show.
Thank you for having me, Mike. Mike's not here today. I'm so sorry.
We were discussing it, that you wanted to get to know Mike a little better before you wished that he felt better.
Yeah.
Okay. So we'll send you some press stuff. Yeah, I think it's very fair.
I mean, normally I do, you know, promote self, well-being on all persons of the world. That said, we all have those people that we think, well, they probably could use a little bit of a comeuppance. They probably could use a little humbling. And who am I to speak? I mean, clearly he has some success. But at whose or what expense?
You know, we've had a lot of guests on the show. We've never had that take. I love it. Yeah. I have to ask you this, starting about Tapawingo. We all watched it. We all loved it. My son loved it. And I think one of the highest pieces of praise I can give it, and Josh agrees with me on this, we were about 5 or 10 minutes into the film when we said, I can't wait to watch this again. I mean, even before the movie was done, it was so rich with stuff that was fun to hear and look at. When you look at a movie like that, and of course that's, you know, Napoleon Dynamite was the same way, but let's focus on Tapawingo. When you saw the final product on the screen, were you pleased with the richness of the presentation and the fact that there's just so much to take in?
Oh yeah, for sure. No, we were, I mean, like, you know, when you're shooting it, you're like, gosh dang, there's so much we're shooting and there's so much like in the script. And I mean, knowing we're going to have to take stuff out, and it still feels like it's jam packed full of things that, you know, that made it into the film. And then there's, you know, so much that didn't make it in. And, you know, it's hard being a filmmaker when you know what you're missing, but
yeah,
audience doesn't know. So as long as they like what they see, that's really what we are shooting for, right?
And are we going to get? Are we going to get a 4-hour mega cut with all the stuff that was removed?
Oh, if it was up to the director, he will gladly put a director's cut on the DVD, a director's cut. There's going to be a 2-hour, 4-hour. Yeah.
Yes, I know Chad also wants a lot more.
I think there was talk at one moment when, you know, in the editing process, like, what if we put in theaters with an intermission, and we were like. I don't know if that works. Maybe on the DVD.
Love it.
When do you when you read a script and it's clearly that it's an oddball character like Napoleon, so you've learned that you like the script, but then you're putting your hands into this director you've never worked with before. How does that trust process go down? How do you decide, yeah, I trust him with this story, that I want to be a part of it?
There's not much to it besides just trust. You just hope. You just hope. I mean, I don't even know if it's, I call it trust. You just kind of assume and hope, like, all right, it's in your hands and I'm going to do what I can. I mean, you know, I am me. I ultimately can't be forced to do anything. I can maybe be persuaded or pushed in a certain direction. And ultimately, if my performance is bad, I rarely would ever blame that on the director. It's still going to be me. That said, you know, it could be. And it's like, well, it was a bad, maybe it was a bad performance. Maybe if I had been directed well and stuff, it's still on my part. So I have to hope and somewhat trust that the director and I will see eye to eye and that we will, see this character in its full glory, 100% in sync with each other.
Yeah, we spoke with your director, Dylan Narang, and it sounds like you guys got along quite well.
Yeah.
And one thing that we talked to him about, and I want to ask you about it, is the pacing of the movie is sort of an offbeat rhythm. And being raised as a radio guy, when we do our job, I don't like silence. But when you do silence on screen, it's nothing short of brilliant. It's brave. I mean, when someone is got the focus of the crowd and they're not, you know, really chewing the scenery, you're just there quietly reacting. And it's sensational. Did you pick that up along the way? Is that sort of the way you are in real life? Just you pause in such a way that it makes an awkward scene even more awkward.
That's just a personal, like, I love that. I love it in films and in characters and in myself. Like, I think, you know, in comedies and in real life, and it's just, you can talk a ton, and so many jokes in movies come through the dialogue.
Right.
I think so much can be said in, you know, this, not just the subtext, but literally someone will say something, but it's almost like the setup of a joke.
Right.
And then the silence is in the imagination of the audience. Like the punchline is kind of like what you don't hear. So you're kind of coming up with the punchline yourself while the characters on screen are giving you the time, the silence, to figure it out. If that makes sense. And that's, I think, part of the fun for me, because it will be different for everybody else.
It makes 100% sense to me, because, I mean, the reason a joke normally works is the ending is something unexpected. And if we're expecting a hammered in punchline and you don't give it to us, it's funny because it's not usual.
Yeah. Or sometimes it's like, sometimes we'll, you know, say a line and then there'll be a joke.
Mm-hmm.
Then the silence gives you time to just kind of also digest how you would react to it, what the other characters, and I think it also is strong on building a world with not just characters. So often comedies are more about, like, you have one or a couple funny people, but they're telling the joke to you, the audience.
Mm-hmm.
So you're the one who's going to react. Where in these kind of movies, I say the kind of comedies that I like, yes, mm-hmm. Napoleon, something like Top of Wingo, you are as an audience member are becoming, you're not just sitting there in the audience, you're hanging out in their world. So you are watching, the part of the joke is watching the reaction of the other characters,
mm-hmm.
the people. Exactly. So you can become one of them.
And that's,
that makes sense.
Yeah. My favorite example of that in Tapawingo is you sitting there eating breakfast when Tom Roan just comes and puts his hand on your shoulder. And there's no words necessary. Everyone knows what's going on there.
John Ratzenberger. Beloved from, I have just a quick aside. Was it cool to work with him? I imagine we're in the same age demo.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You probably watched Cheers growing up. So what was it like when you met him?
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, it's like anything, when you work with someone that you've watched a lot of their work, I've seen every episode of Cheers.
Sure.
I mean, and not, you know, all the other stuff, but like, that's just like, oh yeah, this is him. And yet, and you think, you like, I don't know. I thought he did such a beautiful job on this film. It's so
really fun. Great.
He gets so many great laughs.
I love him.
It's wonderful. It was really cool.
All right, back to the timing and pacing of the film. In my head, you're still a relative newcomer to Hollywood. What, 35 years now? 30 years? So that's just the way my wiring is messed up.
I think Napoleon's like 21 years.
21?
Closer to 20 years, but give or take a decade, geez Louise.
Yeah, well, I'm feeling old. It's not you. You look marvelous. I've got 1 foot in the grave. But what I wanted to ask is, when you started 20-some years ago, was it weird when there would be a lingering close-up on your face while filming? Did that feel awkward to you? And if it did, could you use that awkwardness?
I guess it depends on the project you're thinking. When I did Napoleon, my first movie, that was all, like, we loved it. Like, anytime the camera was close or even got close, the closer the better. Mm-hmm. And if it wasn't close, it doesn't matter. Like, we had a language and a sense of exactly what we wanted. And I say we, as in Jared and I, and all the filmmakers, like, we knew what we were doing for that film. But also, we didn't have the stress of, like, this was in a studio film. There was no producer sitting behind the scenes like, all right, you got to try this and this isn't going to work. Whereas, cut to like a few years after Napoleon, I'm doing bigger studio films,
right?
And you got a big camera or a couple cameras at the same time on you, you're almost like, oh shoot, now I'm in the big leagues. Like, of course you're gonna think that way, and you're gonna be, now let's, whether or not you handle it professionally or not, you're certainly feeling the pressure.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't call it anxiety, but yeah, you feel more of the pressure.
Now, are you able to use that pressure?
Oh yeah. I think, I feel I do. Mm-hmm. I've always enjoyed it because I think I started my career doing the close-ups and you're going to do close-ups in film and especially with a movie like Napoleon, where you have the awkward silences and you really have so much to be said in the acting of the in between the moments of talking, mm-hmm. How you look and how you move, I think is so important. And so having starting out with that kind of experience, that helped me for future projects for sure.
You mentioned Napoleon, and I just think of certain rhythm breaks in the film, like the jumping of the bike, that really, you don't expect that to be in the movie when they take the bike up the ramp and it's not the best jump. But it's just, it's a great, it's like the dot on the I. It makes the gag absolutely work. Question for you as a performer, do you look at your dailies? Do you watch the film as it comes along, or do you leave that in the hands of your director?
I that's one of the things I leave in the hands of the director.
Okay.
I'm just kind of like, I think if I were the director, it totally makes sense. You watch everything, but as an actor, you're like, well, there's so much I could say about my performance in this scene, but then I might get distracted by something else. And I don't see exactly what he's seeing or putting the story together the same way. So I just leave it alone. It would be it's too hard. And that goes for like even the final cut of the film, the rough cuts of the film as it comes along. This film, Topolwingo, for example, he kept trying to show me like, hey, can I send you this? This is the most recent cut. I'm like, no, it was done. As a filmmaker, yes, I want to see how it's coming, but I also, not being on the producer side or the, and I was kind of a producer on this. I worked very closely with the director, giving lots of notes back and forth. So I did end up watching, yes, rough versions. And this one, I took a little bit more of a producer's standpoint and role, where I would watch it. And then I would give him notes like, I think this, because I was very much invested in this project, not just as an actor portraying my character, but I really wanted the story to come through. I wanted everybody, as like this film has an amazing cast,
yes,
a huge group of crazy characters, and I wanted them all to shine. I wanted the story to work. And like any film, you just want the whole project to work. And so I put more into this one that I have in other films.
Because, yeah, John, the movie seems personal. It feels like you are very much invested in it. When you first saw it, though, be it a rough cut, were you dazzled by the color? And did you expect the color to look like that? It is a beautiful film. I mean, it just screams color. I love it.
I did expect that. I remember, you know, shooting it and being the main character. Like, I interact with every character in the film. I was in almost every shot.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, you know, being there on set and seeing the meticulousness of not just the DP, but Dylan Naring as well. Just being like, hey, I want every shot to have this and that. And, you know, I saw the wardrobe and I remember thinking, I mean, when we're shooting, I was like, this is a very colorful film. This is very, but not having seen, because it's very frame friendly, you know, the way they shot, mm-hmm. they wanted it to look like every shot is a frame, every shot. And it felt like that. I mean, it was shooting. I've never done so much like on this film, hitting your mark acting.
Okay.
And you, I mean, a lot of people probably know about that. You know, as an actor, you got to hit your mark to like, to get to the right spot so that you're not like, okay, I land and I'm over here or something
right,
like that
right,
and they
right.
can't see you. So you got to hit your marks. But this one, it's not just like where you're standing, but where you're holding things. If you pick something up, it was like 3D XYZ axis acting where I had to like hold the little button right here, hold the ding dong right here, and you don't go any higher or lower. I mean, it was so precise. So I was like, this movie better look awesome.
Well, it does look awesome. It really, really does. And we spoke to your director about it. And he said one of the things they were trying to convey is that this movie, although it's not really easy to place the exact year it takes place, it's obviously in the past a little bit. And when you have memories of the past, they're more vivid than they are in, say, real life. And so without even realizing it, I watched the movie. I said, this has sort of a dreamlike is not the word, but sort of like I'm remembering it already because the color is just really dazzling. I really like that.
Bill definitely had something he was going for. Mm-hmm. And it worked.
Yeah. I think there's a nostalgia, you know, bit, and it's kind of a romanticized version of the crusty 1981 back roads, across the train tracks kind of world. That's what I love about it, because it's like in another director's hands, this could have been shot in a way that was like very raw.
Yeah.
And very kind of like really looks authentic from that time, and shoot it in a different way where it's floating. And that could have worked as well. But this felt to me more like I said, or romanticized. Like,
yeah.
I love how you made it like it sounds like, yeah, it's nostalgia, and how we remember it, we're going to exaggerate just a little bit to make more of this colorful, fun. It's a positive look back on that time.
Yeah, I just think it's fantastic. I want to ask you about one of your co-stars, Kim Matula. Am I saying Matula right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I believe so. as far as I know.
It's fun. It's funny to me that, you know, what starts out as a very, you're sort of at odds with her, and then you really end up having a chemistry with her, and you're not a couple in the movie Tapawingo. You're not a couple that you would picture together, and yet you fall in so nicely together. Was it easy to work with her? Is some of that a real life chemistry that came through?
She was so perfectly cast for that role.
Agreed.
When I read it, this was one of the few times I read the script and it, you know, not having seen the movie before and reading the script, she is not that her character. You do not see them getting together.
Right.
Because you're kind of like not, it's not that you're not on her side. You're following Nate's story.
Mm-hmm.
And she just comes in like, oh, she's the bad girl. But like, she's no good.
Right.
She's kind of rotten. She kind of gives this feeling like, and you know, in the script, like, you know, she's hot, but she, you know, that's all it is.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, she's just this hot mama who's really just treats everybody like dirt. And you're like, oh, he's going to like her, but really it's going to be like, no, she was bad for you. You need to like look into yourself and see that you're better than that. Like, that's honestly where I was going when I read the script. But then as you kept reading the script, by the end, you're like, oh, oh, I see what they're doing. And I loved that. I loved it that because it was unexpected. And I thought, so after reading it and then, you know, kind of getting a little bit involved in the casting process and, you know, Dylan sending me stuff, I thought Kim was perfect.
She was really great.
She was great. She plays it well. And on set, we got along great. And so it just worked nicely.
And that's what I was wondering, just with the cast as a whole, how much you were involved in that, because there's so many odd characters in this and everyone is a star in their own way in this movie.
Yeah.
I totally agree. I again, you know, I was attached to this first, and then Dylan would just send me tapes, you know, on like, hey, we're casting right now. What do you think of this person? What do you think? Give me your favorite. So yeah, it was nice to have a bit of a say in like who I'm going to be working with in this and that. But most of them, I think all of them I never worked with. And they were great. They were perfect. Everybody was just perfect.
You can feel there's almost an understated camaraderie. Everybody just works well together. Even when Gina Gershon takes the time to ugly herself up, which is a shame. I imagine she'll look great at the premiere. But yeah, I didn't recognize her. I knew she was in the movie, but I didn't recognize her because you did such a great job making that character.
Oh, that was her. That was her. She came in.
Oh, she did that.
Oh, Dot was like, I mean, there was like, and that's, you know, again, a great example of when sometimes just due to casting and you get an actor and there's a certain take that the writer takes in the script. And then when you get a certain actor, it's not that they disagree with it, but they know how to work towards their strengths. And Gina just brought a little bit of a different vibe than what her character was in the script. And it just worked great. So it was, that was mostly her saying like, I want to do this. I want to do this.
And it speaks highly of the director that he allows it to happen and turn it into something as great as it was.
Yeah.
That's very cool. We are talking to John Heater. He is the star of Tapawingo. To look at the two of us, you wouldn't think that Josh and I are very similar, but we both had one big takeaway from the movie that we both agreed upon, and that is the car. Your car is so great. Josh, I mean,
well, it fits into that dream aspect of being a 20-year-old kid, the type of vehicle you'd want to drive to kind of run around town in.
Yeah.
And it just fits with the character so well that the car and all the cars throughout the movie become stars in their own of this.
Yeah.
Was the Dune Buggy always in the script, or how'd you find the perfect vehicle for you to run around in?
I believe the Dune Buggy was in the script. I don't 100% remember, but I'm pretty sure it was because I got early on, you know, reading the script, I thought, okay, I can see where there's some Napoleon, you know, parallels here. But what I loved about it is that this is a guy who is taken the time since high school to kind of now, like, he might have been an awkward guy in high school, but now, and he still lives at home, but he doesn't see it as a loser thing. Like, now he's in his 30s, possibly his 40s, who knows? And he has collected the elements in his life to make him feel like, no, this is rad. Like, whether he saved up enough and he got the Dune Buggy, he's got the cool clothes, he's got the cool hairstyle, like, he's a cool dude and he kind of knows it. And he is just like rock and roll dude, whatever. And there's like this badass kind of quality to him that doesn't care, even though there is obviously some major, you know, he's super lacking in certain skills.
Sure.
And so this or that, but like, he still is like, no. He owns that Dune Buggy. Yeah. And that was a big part of, I believe it was in the script, because I remember, you know, even before getting to location, like, and flying into Virginia where we shot it, the director just showing me pictures and saying, get ready, you're going to get some lessons on how to ride this. Because that sucker was, he was not easy.
Yeah.
Not easy to ride. But once you got that thing flying, it was really fun. But it's, and it was fun, but it was loud as could be. I still don't know how we got through the audio on that, but it was super loud. It was hard to start. It was hard to, like, again, like I said, hitting marks. Oh boy, we had to do so many things where you get it exactly. It was like, this thing was a monster. And it wasn't like something, I mean, people forget in, you know, movies, maybe most, you know, studio films, you can probably get exactly what you need. If you need a car that looks old but runs well, you could get that. This is not the case. This is like, it looks the part right, but in order to look that, it's authentic, and therefore it was a piece of garbage. And
I love it. I think it is, it might not be Batmobile level, but it is an iconic car, and I think you will be attached to it for a while. I put it above Jim Rockford's Firebird. I think it's a great car.
Now, it was rad.
One of my favorite jokes in the movie, very subtle, is when you first pick up Oswald and you say, take off your glasses, they're going to blow off. And he says, no, they won't. And they promptly do. And it's just, it's exactly what you want to happen. Now, how old, I know the movie, is, you finished filming a couple of years ago. How old was Sawyer Williams when he made the movie? Do you know?
He was 13.
He turns in a hell of a performance for a 13-year-old. Was he fun to work with?
Oh, yeah. You know, it was like, I love working with, you know, like the young people. And he was right at that age where he really was just an awkward kid, you know, transitioning from childhood to teenagerdom. And
sure,
he had the voice crack and everything. And he was trying. So there was still a large level of humility there, which, you know, is appreciative in any professional actor. But, you know, this is his first gig. I mean, this is his first movie. And so it was great. Yeah.
Did he know you from Napoleon?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I assume everyone knows you as Napoleon.
No, I said not as Napoleon, from Napoleon.
From Napoleon. Okay. Yeah. Well, if he knows me as Napoleon, then they hopefully know me from Napoleon.
I'm curious. There's a couple pretty intense, and you keep talking about hitting marks. I hadn't thought about that, but I think it was Spencer Tracy who said, if you know your lines, hit your marks, and don't bump into the furniture, you can be a movie star. So that's what he said. But there are some choreographed sequences. What was the hardest thing to shoot in the movie? Is there one scene that was daunting or you had to keep going back to, or did the whole thing run rather smoothly?
Oh, I'm trying to think. Man, I'd have to sit down and like watch it all. I mean, there's so many different locations and setups.
The fight is one that comes to mind.
It was hard in a way. It wasn't like crazy technical. If you watch it, it's pretty pathetic. Like, I love that it all comes down to this, and it's just the lamest fighting and on purpose, you know?
Yeah. But
it was hard because it was so hot. I mean, we were in Virginia in the summer. It was
You were like Richmond adjacent, right? Yeah. In the middle of summer.
We shot that whole scene in Richmond. That was in Richmond. But most of it takes place in Hopewell, or was shot in Hopewell, which is about like 45 minutes south of Richmond.
Richmond, because of its location between the river and the mountains, is the hottest, most miserable city in the summer. I went to school there.
Yeah.
So I can, not a lot of sweating in the movie. I have to applaud your makeup crew because I know everyone had to be drenched.
There was times I was like, don't wipe off too much, you guys. This is like 80, like I want us to look a bit shiny. I want us to be a little shiny. I don't think we were shiny enough, but that was hard. I mean, I'm trying to think. There was not a ton. Every shot was hard because we were very specific. We had, besides the Doom buggy, there's the big mobile home that the twins drive.
Of course,
and that was also like a total lemon. It was just hard to drive. I mean, everything was really, I had to learn how to ride that little mini bike. I mean, it was fun. We had some fun wheels on that film, but it was.
Speaking of vehicles, did I hear that Billy Zane's vehicle got impounded while shooting the movie?
Like his personal vehicle?
No, the vehicle in the movie that he drives.
I don't remember. I wasn't there. Those were one of the few things I didn't shoot was his scenes. I don't remember.
I believe I was told something about that, but I'll have to double check.
I would have been surprised.
They had to change vehicles because it got taken away.
That's pretty funny. That is funny. And, you know, I've been in Richmond. They love taking your car away. They love it. They absolutely love it. you have the greatest, you know, lineage. I think maybe the most quotable movie in the past 50 years might be Napoleon Dynamite. And I have to tell you this just off. That is a movie that I loved the first time I saw it. And every time I watched it since, I've liked it better. Both my kids loved it. My wife loves it. My grandfather at 89 loved Napoleon Dynamite. We'd watch it on a fairly regular basis. And there's so many great catchphrases from it. When you go into a movie like this, do you think that can be a catchphrase? This is something that's going to be remembered by the movie? Or does that stuff happen organically?
Oh, man. I mean, that's just like, I think it's more organic, you know. I mean, some movies we see, you know, where, again, if you have studio budgets, studio marketing,
mm-hmm.
and they try to shove it in your face and they,
yeah,
and they can almost, to a degree, I mean, if a movie stinks, it stinks no matter how much marketing or money you throw at it. But we've seen certain things that, I mean, I believe that there's certain lines from some movies that maybe might never have made it if they hadn't been marketed that way. Like,
I really see.
Shoved down your throat. But for the most part, people quote things because, you know, they have the staying power that it hits. So that's up to the audience. You know, if they like it, I think this is the kind of film that does let, you know, you frame the dialogue. You know, like we were talking about, the way you frame the visuals, like Napoleon, like Wes Anderson, like this kind of film, you know, you frame the dialogues in a way so that it's not muddied up when, and it's hard to, you know, get through all the dirt and the muck to like single out some of these lines. These get their own pedestal. Each line gets its own pedestal. And you know, some of them are going to be quotable and hopefully, right. you know, they stick.
When you were making Napoleon, when you were a young Hollywood up and comer, did you feel that there was the potential for the catchphrases to go wild?
I did.
Did you hope?
Well, it was more like, I guess I hoped. It was more like, I knew it had the potential. I knew the way I looked at it was always, it was the reality of the situation. I knew I was in an independent film that was being made by college students
mm-hmm.
that may never see the light of day. So I knew it was like, well, for all we know, like, you know, nobody will see this movie. Even if sure. we think it's great, I think it had the potential.
Mm-hmm.
If people see this, I don't see why they wouldn't totally quote it, but only if they get it. And because I was going off of, like, we did a short film of Napoleon first
mm-hmm.
a couple of years prior, and that had that, and that worked so well. But it right. was a short film. You have a small group of people who see that thing, but those who did see it quoted it. I loved it. I was like, this is the kind of movie I quote.
Mm-hmm.
We did a feature version of it. You know, we had different cast. We shot it in color. We shot it on, it was just shot differently. I was like, maybe this won't translate and maybe not, but if it does,
mm-hmm.
and boy, we've got all these characters, each one with their own catchphrases. Not that we were shooting for that, because they weren't like repeating. Yeah. Napoleon says his gosh.
Yeah.
Idiot. And he'll say that over and over, but it felt less like we didn't want it to feel like an SNL sketch
right.
that was running the lines, you know, over and over and over just to get it to stick. It was more right. like, it was simple stuff that, you know, you would say in real life anyway.
It never felt, here's this word again, it never felt unorganic during Napoleon, yeah. whereas by the time it's the third sketch of a recurring character on Saturday Night Live, you're done, because yeah. they've done everything they can do with it. You majored in computer animation. Yeah. And 3D animation at Brigham Young?
Yeah.
So how cool was it in 2012 when you got to do the Napoleon Dynamite cartoons? Was that your first toe dip into real big animation?
No, I had done voice work for animations before that. More, I was studying like 3D animation, computer animation. I had done voices on Surf's Up, on Monster House, on a couple other projects. So by the time this came around, this was more like, this felt less animation and just, again, doing more of Napoleon. I mean, it was all the same cast, the same writer. And
did you get to record with the other cast members or was it done separately? Because it had to be a blast to get in there with the same people and revisit the characters and not have to do makeup.
It was amazing. And it really was like, you know, we had always, me and the rest of the cast have always seen each other throughout the years for reunions or little special screenings. A movie like this has brought us together, you know, over the course of the last 20 years. And so doing the animation wasn't like, oh, we hadn't seen, but there was still a handful of some of the cast that we had not seen. Plus getting together everybody at the same time when we did the table reads or the animations, that was like magic. Cause that was so cool. Everybody at once. Whereas when we recorded, you maybe record at the same time as one other person or, you know, whatever.
So you've been married a long time. How long? 22 years?
23.
23 years. How many? Yeah. And you have three kids?
Four.
Four. Okay. I saw sources that said both. So four kids. I won't tell
your math's
you which
been
one.
Wrong all day. It's
I know. I'm not going to tell which kid I forgot because they'd hate me. I'm curious. How old are the kids, and are they aware of what you do?
My oldest is 18.
Oh gosh!
My youngest,
wow.
And then I have a 16 and a 12-year-old and an 8-year-old.
So obviously they know what you do.
Yeah, they know what I do. And my two oldest are kind of like, you know, they're the teenagers where my two younger ones were the younger ones, a little bit of a split there. But I've seen, you know, two of them go through teenagerdom. And at first, you know, when they were younger, they were like, okay, this is cool but it's different because like anything else, they weren't introduced to the movie first and thought, this is a great movie. Oh, whoa, it's you, Dad. You know, they see Dad, and before they even see the movie, they just know Napoleon Dynamite to them is a magic word. If we say that word, or if we hear that in public, then people are going to react. And it was almost like not just a magic word, but they could use it. My two younger kids, my 12-year-old would like 3 or 4, you know, 3 years ago, I remember him just loving to say, like, when we were in public, he'd be like, he's Napoleon Dynamite. He knew if he said it, then he would get reaction so he could have control.
That's pretty smart.
The younger kids think it's more, you know, like, oh, this is cool. My daughter, my youngest one, she likes the movie. So she's the only one who will actually say she likes it. I think my 12-year-old will... I think it's cool that you're in it. Do I like it? I don't think he thinks anything other. And my teenagers don't have an opinion. I don't think they think of it as bad or good. They're just like, it's a home video.
Mine are 23 and 25 now. You're going to get a lot cooler in the next 5 years.
I just want
you to know that. They're going to love what you do. We're talking to John Heater about his new movie, Tapawingo, which starts today, available to rent anywhere you rent movies. You've been so generous with your time. I have one last question. I read that you are a Led Zeppelin fan. What's their best LP?
I would probably, that's funny you say that because, you know, even recently, I mean, I've always, you know, they're my favorite band.
Right.
But only like recently this year, because I re-downloaded the new remastered off of Apple. And so I've been like going through all that and trying to teach my 12-year-old like the beat of it, because he loves Immigrant Song because it was in one of the Thor movies. And then something, I was like, well, if you like that, let me. And so I've been playing a lot of it recently. So it's very funny you ask. And I, you know, you've always wondered that question because I've never had a direct answer, like one or two or three or four. But you know what? I feel like two, Led Zeppelin two might be the most solid from beginning to end, not one. They don't have bad songs, I don't think, in any of their others. But I could just like the way it flows.
Yeah.
It's just kind of perfection. I kind of feel that way about the fourth one as well.
I agree. The fourth is my favorite because I know you care.
Oh, I do. I do care. You're Zeppelin head, you know, you Zepp head. I care. I love them all so much. I mean, they feel like my babies. It's
just
weird.
Be careful because my daughter, Julia, stole my copy of Led Zeppelin 3 and then denied it. I said, I don't find my copy of Led Zeppelin 3 around here. She said, I don't know where it is.
I would be more than happy if my kids were stealing my CDs. I think that would be great. Because, you know, like anything, when they're younger, they're like listening to music and they think it's cool.
Right.
And now they get, and then they get in their teens, they're like, oh my gosh, are you kidding? None of your stuff is good. I was like, that is a lie and you know it because you are quoting. I know your musical history and you're only listening to that because of this, which I introduced you to, you know, it, like you said, probably in 5 years, I'll get some appreciation.
Well, good for you. John Heater, Tapawingo is streaming or rentable today, anywhere you can stream movies. You were charming and a thrill to speak to, and I just can't say thank you enough. I really appreciate you joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
And so check out Tapawingo. You will like it. That is my personal guarantee to you. Again, thank you to John Heater. Thank you to Chad Dukes. And thank you to Dylan, our fine director who made all this happen. Go check this movie out. You'll like it. Have a great day, everybody. And if it's not too early, John, this will be the first time I say it this year. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Thank you so much.
See you later.